Good morning, Eric. Excuse me. Good morning, Eric.
Don't represent. Just hold on for a little bit. Yeah. Sit down. Okay. You may proceed. Did you wish to reserve any time?
Yes, 3 minutes, please. Good morning, Eric Dunn, representing the Hanlons, the appellants in this case, and we are seeking reversal of a trial court's order dismissing their claim under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. This case is exclusively brought under the Washington Fair Credit Act. We did not raise any federal Fair Credit Reporting Act claims. And the Washington Fair Credit Reporting Act is one of those consumer protection statutes that's enforced through the State Consumer Protection Act, and so it's subject to the Hangman Ridge five-factor test. And the reason the trial court dismissed the case here is because the court found that we did not plead what the trial court called an actual injury. Of course, under the Hangman Ridge test, one of the requirements is showing an injury to business or property, which is distinct from a showing of actual damages. Now, in this case, the crux of the matter is that the Hanlons were entitled to two different sets of consumer disclosures from the defendant on-site manager. One set was what are called post-reinvestigation disclosures. They had disputed information that on-site had reported to a landlord. On-site had reinvestigated that information and made a correction to its report. That triggers a statutory duty to make a set of disclosures under Section 090 of the Fair Credit Reporting Act within 5 business days. On-site never made those disclosures at all. Secondly, the Hanlons had requested a set of disclosures under Section 070 of the statute. On-site manager eventually did make those disclosures, but not until 17 days after they'd been requested. And the Hanlons alleged that those disclosures, when received, were incomplete, and they were not produced in the electronic form that they'd requested. Rather, they were sent by regular mail, and that's a large part of the reason why they took so long to arrive. Now, the trial court found that even though the Hanlons had alleged that these disclosures either weren't made at all or weren't made properly, that they didn't suffer an injury because of that. And our position is that an injury to property can be established simply by showing an interference with the use or enjoyment of property, and that the disclosures themselves, the consumer reports that they were trying to obtain, were a form of property. In our view, the most relevant case discussing what property is for purposes of the Consumer Protection Act is the Ambach v. French case. And in that case, the court basically explained property for purposes of the CPA by saying you start with all of a person's rights by any description, and then you subtract out rights that relate to a bodily injury or rights over someone's personal condition or other types of property that's derivative of a bodily injury. So, for instance, in the Ambach case, there had been an improper shoulder surgery performed, and the person was arguing that financial costs they'd incurred for corrective procedures and so forth was an injury to property. But the court said, well, that's derivative of your bodily injury to the shoulder, and so we're not going to view that as a type of injury to property for purposes of the CPA. But, of course, the consumer report disclosures required by the Fair Credit Reporting Act are certainly not derivative of bodily injury or not related to someone's personal condition. So we feel that that's where the trial court went wrong and that the disclosures that were requested in this case were a form of property.
Well, it seemed like the trial court's reasoning was, well, okay, you didn't get the disclosures. That's, you know, that may be a violation, but almost seems like it was more of a causation than an injury. It was like, well, what would have been different for you if you would have gotten these disclosures? How would your client's life have progressed in a more financially reasonable manner, in a more business-like manner? How is their business or economic interests harmed by not having this digital information?
Right. Well, in this case, what had happened is the Hanlons had applied for an apartment at a property called Forest View. Now, at the time they applied, they had a limited amount of time to move out of the residence they'd previously been living in. They had until the end of August of 2013. So they applied for the property at Forest View at the beginning of August. their application was turned down because of incorrect information about an eviction lawsuit they'd previously been involved in. They disputed that information and got it corrected on August 9th. And then even though the information was corrected, Forest View still declined their application. And so at that point is when they requested their entire consumer report, their entire tenant screening report, so they could see what else was on there that was causing them to be turned down. And what they had planned on doing was once they got that report, they could see what that information was and then go back to Forest View and have a plan for how to negotiate with Forest View to get admitted to that property. But when the disclosures didn't come, after several days, after a week, eventually, their time to move out of the original property was running out. So at that point, they had to decide, do we start looking for another place to move to and give up on the Forest View application, or do we just contact Forest View without the benefit of these disclosures and see if we can get admitted anyway? They actually decided to do both. But as it turned out, they applied to another property and incurred additional screening fees and were actually accepted at a different property, signed a rental agreement, and began moving into that property, and then were actually admitted to Forest View. So they were put in this position where they had to resume their housing search, incur additional time, incur additional expenses, and actually give up on...
Part of your point would be that since this was cut off at the 12B6 stage... You still don't really have any idea what those disclosures would have been and whether they would have helped you negotiate with Forest View or not.
Well, the brunt of the disclosures were eventually received, and they were what we kind of guessed that they would have consisted of. But by the time the Hanlons received them, they had already moved into this other property, and so it was sort of water under the bridge at that point.
So it seems like the trial court was sort of looking for you to explain that, to say, well, now that you've got the disclosures, what was in there that would have turned the corner for Forest View and made it possible to get in there?
You're right, Your Honor, and I think that is what the trial court was looking for, and I think that's where the trial court went wrong, because I think that's actual damages. But I think just the mere denial of the disclosures themselves was an injury to property, and I think that's where that distinction comes in. Thank you.
Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Michael Saltz. I represent On-Site Manager Incorporated. And Justice Becker, I believe you hit the nail on the head there that we have a massive causation issue here, one that counsel was never able to address in the court. It's not an issue of damages. It's an issue of did we cause the damages if there are damages.
Well, injury is the word.
Injury, yes. Injury to business or property.
Very broadly defined under the Consumer Protection Act.
Well, correct, except there's two underlying issues, and if this is the first time I think anybody has ever argued that they have a property interest in somebody else's data. They don't have a property interest in that data. They have a right to see what that data is, but they have no property interest in it under the French case. But first, I think that it's important to go through a little bit of that timeline in order to address some...
Before you do that, let me ask you a threshold question about the standard of review. Your brief says that we review 12B6 under Iqbal and Twombly.
My understanding, yes.
Oh, that's incorrect. Washington doesn't follow Iqbal and Twombly. We have a very liberal 12B6 standard. Any hypothetical set of facts that might possibly support a claim.
And that's fine, Your Honor, because what happened in this particular complaint were no set of facts that established that On-Site was the cause of any injury. And we have admissions by counsel during oral argument that constitute a waiver necessarily in order for that to have been amended. And I'll point the court to that specific timeline. Specifically, the complaint alleges that on August 5th, they applied at Forest View and are denied because of the presence of a prior eviction case. Then on August 9th, 2013, plaintiffs contact On-Site through Forest View to update the information on an eviction case about an out-of-court settlement that wasn't inside the court records. On-Site immediately updates the report and sends it to Forest View with all the new information that the Hanlons had requested be in it. Now, despite receiving this updated report containing the information plaintiffs wanted in it, Forest View continued to deny plaintiffs' application. Now, plaintiffs' counsel admitted at oral argument that the continued denial had nothing to do with plaintiffs' rental scores that were allegedly issued by OnSite, but because of their...
Let me ask you a question. Is it undisputed, then, that you did violate the Act's requirements for disclosure? You're just saying no.
That's part of this timeline. We did not. You see, what happened was they never submitted their ID. Within 24 hours of them submitting their ID, the disclosure report was made. And it was made pursuant to the manner in which counsel said it could be made, which was by regular mail. Now, counsel just stood here.
But I mean, the essence of this dispute, as it's come up to us at least, is on the injury and causation. I mean,
that's correct.
For purposes of the complaint, I mean, they allege that you violated the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and there's been very little development that would disprove that or prove it, and, you know, any hypothetical set of facts. So, I mean, unless you're going to ask us now for the first time to think about, well, actually, under this complaint, they couldn't possibly prove that you even violated the Act.
Well, that's not the issue, Your Honor. The problem here that we have is that the claimed, we deny that we violated the Act.
All right.
Okay.
But on 12B6, they could prove it.
Right. We assume that all of the facts in the complaint are true for the purposes of the 12B6. And then we pointed to what they said, and we said it's impossible that we're the cause of the injury that they are claiming. And let's assume that we violated the Act. We didn't, but let's assume that we violated the Act, because there's a lot of facts that they left out. Under what they pled, we didn't cause the injury that they are suing about. We did not cause that for which they are seeking relief.
Well, if they didn't get disclosures on time, okay.
Okay.
And if disclosures, if the information that you have is a property interest, then they have a claim. So your argument really apparently comes down to information as property.
Except for the fact that they pled that they did get their disclosures on time. First of all, the statute doesn't say what that time period is. It says upon reasonable notice to the consumer reporting agency, and that is only to benefit the consumer reporting agency, not the consumer. The reason why is when these laws were written, we didn't have everything on computer. So what happened was you had to give them notice to go to all the sources that where they were keeping their information, and then they would make an appointment with you in order to get it through. It was only 13 days that went from what they alleged was their first request to the time that it was sent. And during that...
A jury could find, I think, in the context of moving from one apartment to another, 13 days within the one-month period that you usually get, it's pretty important.
Except for the fact that the...
accurate information, and so, you know...
But the complaint... Well, first of all, they said the information was accurate. All right, let's not put things in the complaint where it's not there. And the complaint says they got it within 24 hours of them complying with the federal mandate that they provide ID. 24 hours is all it took for them to get it. And if you look at the timeline, it's very, very clear. Understand that August 13th is the first time that plaintiffs allege that they submitted to online a request for disclosure of their consumer information. They do not allege that they provided on-site with any ID information. Then on August 16, 2013, just 3 days later, plaintiff's attorney writes a letter demanding a disclosure. That was sent on a Friday. The following Monday, OnSite gets that letter, drafts a response, says, please provide us the ID, and that goes out on the 20th, which is Tuesday. On the 19th, Hanlon's request that Forest View, without the benefit of any disclosure report, reconsider their information. On the 21st, they sign a contract with another entity, not waiting for Forest View to give them a response. On the 22nd, Forest View gives them a response and says, yes, we accept you. And then on the 26th, after they have already been accepted by Forest View, they send their ID. The complaint says for the first time they send their ID.
You're getting a really, really nuanced factual kind of narrative here that is normally something that if there's a factual dispute at a 12B6 stage, you know, we're not going to decide that, right? But the essential concept here, as I understand it, is that they've alleged a violation of the Fair Credit Reporting Act in the sense that they claim that you didn't provide information in a timely way as required by the statute. Okay, so that's an allegation of a violation, and you're saying in response, yes, but information is not property. So there wasn't any injury.
Well, it's not their property. No court in this country has ever determined in any state, federal or state, that that's a property interest of an individual,
okay,
that a consumer has property interest in what...
Here's the policy question. I mean,
sure.
Your obligation under the Act is to provide certain information to consumers and to provide it in a timely fashion, and you fail to do that. And this state has determined that such a violation is to be handled under the Consumer Protection Act. How do your violations get enforced? How does your failure to comply with your requirements ever lead to success in a consumer lawsuit?
You mean what would actually have to happen?
Let's just assume. I understand you disagree with everything that I'm saying about what happened, but let's just assume that a consumer protection agency, not yours, anyone,
sure,
maybe yours, maybe another one, doesn't comply. They say, we have this information, we don't feel like giving it to you. It's just too busy or whatever. And negligence, malice, carelessness, whatever it is. You don't comply with the obligation to give people their credit information in the timely fashion that the Act requires. Okay? Now, that's at least the first three elements of a Consumer Protection Act violation. How does anybody ever prove a Consumer Protection Act violation if the information isn't property? If it isn't an injury to business or property not to receive. Well,
very similar to the federal FCRA, the Washington legislature specifically said we want only certain lawsuits where people are actually damaged in order to go forward, and we reserve the rest for
injury,
the enforcement.
Injury,
damage. Yes. And we reserve the rest for the enforcement agencies.
Give me an example, then.
But there's no reason why they can't go to any of the many regulatory agencies and say, I'm having this particular problem. And they then go and enforce the remedy. But more important here was the...
So you would prefer to not have a Consumer Protection Act lawsuit ever brought against a Fair Credit Report?
But that's not what you asked. You asked specifically for disclosures.
I'm asking, how is it... You're saying that's for agencies to regulate. It's not for consumers to bring lawsuits about. When you don't provide the information.
You have to look to see if there's an actual injury, and here there isn't. In this particular situation, the court says, so don't you need to tell me that having the reports in hand, you can point to the information that you think would have made a difference if your clients had received it earlier to their negotiations with Forestview or something like that? Mr. Dunn responded, Your Honor, I didn't come to court today prepared to answer that specific question. And then he said, the only thing that they knew that was wrong, if I may finish the answer. Thank you, Your Honor. The only thing that they knew was wrong, they said, the general description of the reason for continuing denial that we had gotten after August 9th was that it had to do with the negative credit history, which is an on-site. And we anticipated that the reports would show which accounts were showing as delinquent and what the negative credit history was. We thought maybe some of that information might be medical bills that Mr. Hanlon had for which we could ask that they be overlooked as a reasonable accommodation. We thought there might be different types of challenges that could present to Forest View saying why they should admit the Hanlons after all. We wound up having to just kind of guess at what we thought might be in there with the August 19th letter. Now, that is in the RP, page 30, lines 8 through 20, and he said the information that they were looking for is not the information that they get from on-site. That's the information they get from another credit bureau. They were told what that credit bureau was, and they didn't go to them and get it. And that's why there's no causation, and that's why there's no injury to their business or to their property. Thank you, Your Honor.
To clarify what counsel just described, a tenant screening report, or what I think of, sorry, my voice is not cooperating. A tenant screening report, or what I think of as a tenant screening report, is usually actually a compilation of a number of different items of information drawn from a number of different sources. And usually the credit report portion is something that the tenant screening company would purchase from another consumer reporting agency such as Experian or Equifax or TransUnion, and then they would put that credit report information in their tenant screening report. And usually they'll only take certain accounts from the broader credit report that the landlord thinks are relevant to the rental application. So even though the information about the person's credit that shows up in the tenant screening report may have originated with a different company, it's still important to get the tenant screening report to see which of the accounts that landlord was looking at and were causing the denial. So it's really not accurate to say that OnSite didn't have anything to do with this information or wasn't the relevant source of the information. Secondly, I acknowledge that there really is a good question about whether there are actual damages in this case, or what I should say is whether there are actual damages caused by OnSite. But I think there's no question that there's an actual or that there's an injury to property. And I think it's important to keep in mind that the Fair Credit Reporting Act provides for statutory damages, I think largely because a lot of times in these types of situations, there may not be any actual damages or there may be very small negligible actual damages. I think even in this case, my client's actual damages might be limited to the additional screening fees they paid at the apartment complex where they wound up moving to, which you know, is under $100, I think. So,
well, counsel argues that you know, there aren't any cases that say that information is property. Are you aware of any cases that address that issue? Because that is essentially what you're arguing, isn't it?
The state Washington's Fair Credit Reporting Act is quite a bit different than the federal Fair Credit Reporting Act, and the vast majority of the case law discussing, you know, credit reporting are federal cases interpreting the federal statute. So the injury to property element wouldn't be discussed under that provision. But I think the Ambach case is very clear. It says property includes all of a person's rights by any description, and it goes on to describe contractual rights and things of that nature. And I don't see why information is not a form of property. It has a number of characteristics of property.
I mean, that really is a pivotal issue in the case.
Well, I would keep in mind that we're talking about a report. The information appears on a certain form, and I guess I'm out of time, but I'll just say we think information in this context is property and should be treated as such.
Thank you.
That's all I can say. Thank you.